Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Alfred Frankowski about his new book, The Post-Racial Limits of Memorialization, Towards a Political Sense of Mourning. Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'll be talking to Alfred Frankowski, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy and African American Studies program at Northeastern Illinois University. His new book is called The Post-Racial Limits of Memorialization, Towards a Political Sense of Mourning, and it's actually the first in a new book series by Lexington Books about the philosophy of race. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
This is a fascinating and really timely book, I think, and speaks obviously to the American context, but also I think much more globally. So it'd be great to hear a bit about the project in which the book has kind of emerged from. And I suppose you might be able to do that by thinking about the two events that introduced the book, the re-election of Barack Obama and the Trayvon Martin murder. So why were they a good starting point for the argument the book wants to make?
Yeah, the book project originally started from thinking about forgetting and how forgetting plays out in a especially for histories that are affected by extreme violence. But as I was working on that question, I started to then think about the way in which we use memory and memorials to try and reconcile our past. And within that context, I started to look specifically at anti-Black violence in the United States. At the same time, I was very aware of how the Barack Obama presidency started to become described as a post-racial presidency, and the term post-racial had been around for quite a while before Barack Obama, and questions about post-ethnic futures and things like that had been around for a while. But what was interesting, I think, about the Barack Obama presidency and why that became sort of important for this work was that whether or not we were there were lots of questions about whether or not we were a post-racial society, and what we meant by post-racial. Are we a post-racial society because we are suddenly past race, or are we a post-racial society because now we can look at race more critically? And all of those questions are interesting questions to take up, but whether or not they're true, whether or not they're descriptive, seems somewhat irrelevant to the fact that what was being produced, or what we're kind of engaged in when we talk about race now, is a post-racial discourse. And so Barack Obama, on the one hand, signals a way in which we are post-racial because we've progressed as a society to think about and handle and accept and represent race and racial diversity in multiple ways. But that's not the whole story, and that's not the whole way in which the discourse ought to be framed. Trayvon Martin's murder was also also a representation of where we're at when we think about race, which would be in a state of complete denial. So the Trayvon Martin murder repeats in many ways the most extreme forms of racial violence and anti-Black violence. And the trial itself acts as a context through which we can see the repetition of the ways in which our culture is immersed in and sort of entrenched in anti-Black violence. So I thought it was very important for us to sort of think about the term post-racial as doing these two, as embracing these two sides, one that is one, on the one hand, gesturing towards progress, and on the other hand, signaling that we have not moved very far, if at all, from that racist past.
Yeah, and this really gets to the core argument of the book, which I read as essentially kind of applying that tension between representations of potential post-racial societies with the reality through aesthetic productions that suggest an inclusive society, but in doing so occlude and make opaque people's suffering. And I wonder if you could expand or perhaps sketch out that argument about the role of aesthetic productions in replicating these forms of racial inequality.
Yeah, I can try and do that in two ways. First, I think that sort of thinking about post-racial discourse, and just specifically in terms of how we sort of think about when we talk about race in our society, when we talk about racism. Not necessarily about race, but when we talk about racism, there seems to be always a gesture, especially in terms of when we think about extreme violence, there's always a gesture just to say that on the one hand, right, we are not the society that we once were. On the other hand, then to then openly talk about or openly represent the violence at hand. So when Trayvon Martin was murdered, when Michael Brown was murdered, I believe that Barack Obama said when he made statements about these, and when people in general, when they publicly talked about either event, they would say, we have a racist past. There's much to deal with, but our society has grown a whole lot from that past. And I would like to stop right there, right? At that point, what seems to be going on is that there's a context through which we're going to view Michael Brown or Trayvon Martin suddenly is in reference to a history, but that history is immediately delinked from the representation of the violence itself. So we say we are not the country that we were, or we say that our country has a history of racism, but we've grown a whole lot from that. And that seems to then suddenly post-racialize whatever comes after it. What I mean by that is that suddenly Trayvon Martin's murder is not seen as a continuation of or a reiteration of that violence. It suddenly becomes just a fluke. It becomes something individual. And so when we then think about George Zimmerman is not a murderer who is represented through the continuation of a history of white supremacy. He's just a neighborhood watchman in an unfortunate event. And the same thing with Trayvon Martin. His body is not simply just a continuation. It's suddenly delinked as something that is particular, and so one way of thinking about post-racial discourse then is to think about that it has this weird relationship to memory and to history. Mm-hmm. It historicizes by way of delinking it from its past, and in doing so, then it can be represented. And I think that another way then to sort of think about this is to think about the history of memorialization in the United States. For a long period of time, to the the establishment of memorials to African American history was distinctly one in which there was sort of hyper censorship of what could be represented. And we could always point to a sort of noticeable lack of memorials or of historical representations. But within the last maybe 15, 20 years, we've seen a ramping up of representations, specifically as long as they are of the civil rights, mainly Martin Luther King or Rosa Parks, of slavery, and some of Jim Crow. Those are sort of the three things that tend to get represented the most. But we have to wonder that with the hyper representation of something, is that just another way to make it go, make the thing that we're representing go invisible? And so I worried then about how in our society we start to use representation as the mechanism through which we make things become decontextualized, and particularly the way in which our racism might not simply attack at erasing the past, but instead will hyper represent it to such an extent that the representation itself becomes a complicitous moment in which we are effectively decontextualizing the racism that we're trying to give an analysis of. And so, as you put it, it's through the representation that suffering becomes more opaque.
Yeah. I wonder, actually, could you say a bit more about that Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial, which is the subject of Chapter 1? Because I think you kind of pin down the idea that memory and a broader memorial culture actually is a form of forgetting with this example.
Yeah. So I would say that the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial, the Stone of Hope Memorial itself is probably the first post-racial memorial, and ought to be thought of in that framework. So the Martin Luther King Memorial, which is in Washington D.C., oddly stands relative to memorials to Lincoln and to Jefferson. Is definitely a sort of moment where we can see that 20 years ago or something like that, we might not have ever thought that we would have a Martin Luther King Memorial in Washington D.C. And so it definitely stands out as that something has changed in our society, that there is sort of a moment of progress here. The Martin Luther King Memorial itself is composed of two parts. There is the Mountain of Despair, which Martin Luther King's image is then taken out of, and that's called the part that stands out from that is called the Stone of Hope. And then there's the basin with his text, with bits of his text scrawled on the walls that surround that basin. And what's interesting about the Martin Luther King Memorial is that, on the one hand, we see this representation of someone who is from the civil rights, who is the icon of the civil rights era. And we immediately start to think about that historical context and how that historical context situates us in the present. But the text that's written along the walls also tells a narrative that's actively commenting on the need to be engaged with the mode of oppression that we are confronted with in the present. And right after the memorial was opened, there were many people who saw many people, especially high school students, who saw the memorial. And the comment that they said, which is striking and telling, is that the text, that when they read the text, that it sounded like he could have been talking about now. And I think that there's something really interesting then about the way in which the monument does two things, right? On the one hand, it sort of sets up a narrative of progress. On the other hand, it disrupts that in such a way that we have to start to then think about why is it that the statements sound more relevant now than they did then. And I think that what we have to worry about is that the when we're confronted with that conflict, we almost immediately then will say that, he couldn't have been talking about now. This was so far in the past. And at that point where the memorial starts to, or the representation starts to act as a type of forgetting, I think that's the most dangerous part about post-racial discourse and post-racial memory, is that in its representation, in the act of memory, the memory itself starts this process of forgetting.
And this plays out as well in specifically in memorials that have engaged with anti-Black violence. And you use Hope Plaza, both the object itself in this memorial, but also thinking through the events that they memorialize as an example of this dual moment of memorialization and forgetting. And I think that's a really interesting example that'd be good to hear a bit more about.
Yeah. Hope Plaza, sort of thinking about those things that we try to memorialize. Hope Plaza was one of the things that when we were, memorializes sort of the 1921 the 1921 Tulsa race riots. And for a very long time, that's been something that has been sort of actively repressed. And so much so that many people didn't learn about the Tulsa race riots who were from Tulsa. They didn't learn about them until much later on in life, until they were in their 30s or 40s. And still it seems like something that it still acts as something that's kind of a hole in our cultural memory. But the 1921 Tulsa race riots was probably one of the worst, if not the worst, the most disastrous race massacres in the United States history, and very few people know that much about it. Now, I want to qualify that, right? Because I think if you consult any text on this, they will say this is a massacre. This is a race riot that was forgotten, and almost all of them will say that. But the problem is that it's not simply that it's been forgotten. There are, several books on the topic. There is the Hope Plaza, right? There are all kinds of ways in which the event itself has been memorialized. In 2012, it was the first year in which it was included in the history books. But that itself, right? That representation itself, while being a move in the, while being important and significant, it becomes also post-racialized in the way in which the representation itself becomes yet another moment of forgetting, right? And so why is it that Tulsa, Oklahoma's race riot continues to unfold under the specter of forgetting? Well, I think what's interesting is that we have to look at then sort of the tactic, right, that's applied to the forgetting that's going on there, right? First, it's sort of just denial, and then it's just sort of adamant erasure. Now it's representation. It's not that we shouldn't represent it. It's that we should be very, very careful about the ways in which representation also facilitates a type of forgetting. And so I think thinking about this within a post as a sort of post-racial limit to memorialization is the more correct way of thinking about it. And we should be very aware of then how questions about how representations displace or decontextualize questions about our own actions and our own agency, especially when it comes to thinking about how we address and confront and make thematic modes of resistance to anti-Black racism.
A final example we might think about before we turn to, I guess, kind of, you know, consider the more aesthetic philosophy elements of the book that come later in chapters 4 and 5 is Strange Fruit, and how you engage with Angela Davis' reading of that song to help us understand how we think about memory and its relationship to oppression. So, what's your reading of Strange Fruit?
Oh yeah, you know, Strange Fruit, I think, is a wonderful example of I think what we should think of, and Angela Davis is particularly astute to point this out. We should think of this as a long tradition, I think, within Black aesthetics of playing right at the edges of representation. And so, Strange Fruit is a remarkable. Remarkable example of also what Du Bois points out at the end of Souls of Black Folk in the Sorrow Songs as an aesthetic of sorrow an aesthetic of sort of clearing the space of representation. So Strange Fruit is often thought of as a song that is about lynching, about someone who is lynched. The author of the song definitely is playing with the images of a lynched body in the South. But Billie Holiday's performance of the song plays with the silence, or sort of silences every moment that would give you the satisfaction of saying, and this is directly about a lynching. And so I think that Angela Davis, I think, is right to point out that this is a song about resistance. It's a sort of rebellion song. And that it crosses over many different aesthetic elements. But what I would point to is that the song, what Billie Holiday introduces into the song is that it becomes not just a song about remembering and responding to the most extreme forms of violence against Blacks, the lynching, the practices of lynching in the United States. It contextualizes that, but it does this weird thing where it decontextualizes our present moment as well. The song is employing the images of lynching, but it's really about violence against Blacks. And every time in the song she could say more or give you the image of make concrete that she's talking about lynching, she follows the lyrics with these long silences. And I think it's the silence, it's that withholding of the act of withholding of a representation that is unsettling to the point where it makes our present strange. And so it's really interesting that the song still has this effect of silencing everyone around it, right? And it still has this sort of interruptive effect. And Du Bois points this out in the Sorrow Songs as part of Black aesthetics. And he says in the Sorrow Songs, he says, these weird songs that came down to me from generations and generations and generations. What strikes him cold now, he says, when he hears them, he knowing nothing about music, he knows much about humans. And knowing men, he says, I know that these tell the story of an unhappy people. So what's interesting about what he's talking about there and how this relates to Strange Fruit is that he says he points out that the words of the songs were sort of English approximations. And so in terms of their words, they lost their meaning. But what they tell us is of a people who have been broken from their history. And they highlight the strangeness of the violence that they're still undergoing. They make the present strange in a very weird way. And I think that Strange Fruit is a sort of contemporary continuation of that aesthetic practice of disengaging disengaging politically in representations, right? The sort of deployment and use of representations by withholding exactly what we might supply ourselves through the representation. So, and in that withholding, it keeps that meaning very fluid. And I think that's extraordinarily important for us to sort of think about as we think about something like memory works. Like, so is there another aesthetic way in which we can go, in which we can think about the politics that seem to be sort of co-opting a representation presently? And I think there is. I think that what Billie Holiday's point in Strange Fruit tells us, what Angela Davis's analysis and what Du Bois's notion of sorrow tells us, is that we should be looking for something that is not simply just representational, and that makes sort of larger claims about how we understand our political activity and our agency communally, as opposed to within our particular groups.
That last point, you know, political question of this aesthetic analysis is obviously a bridge to think about Kantian aesthetics and also to an extent Franz Fanon's work. And that's, you know, really the core discussion point for chapters 4 and 5. So I wonder if you could tell me a bit about how you engage with Kantian aesthetics and I guess where the book kind of leaves Kant after you've engaged with his ideas.
Yeah, well, Kant's definitely a controversial figure within this context.
Very much so, yeah.
I mean, for better or worse, right? What I think is important to sort of think about with Kant, sort of important to retain it with Kant, is that for Kant, everything starts with the aesthetics. And for him, right, following Baumgarten, Kant's aesthetics is distinctly a reference to our sensibility about things, the conditions for the possibility of what we can sense, the conditions for the possibility of not sensing things. And so what we can represent to ourselves and what we cannot represent to ourselves is all within the domain of aesthetics. And so it's very important to sort of think about what Kant then means by giving an analysis of the conditions for the possibility of what we can represent to ourselves. And his aim, as I take it, is not simply a claim about what each individual what each individual's capacities are, but thinking about his work on anthropology and thinking about his work in politics, he tends to mean a representation, it tends to mean something that has some sociability to it. It has a social context through which it has to pass. And then thinking about sort of race discourse as sort of traversing that same trajectory actually becomes something that we have to pay very close attention to. Kant's aesthetics then, I think, has to be paired with, or sort of seen also in line with, or at least in view of, what he has to say about race. And so Kant was, of course, a sort of architect of intellectual racism. But and there's lots of folks talking about, well, how deeply does this cut? Does it go all the way down to his epistemology? Does it go all the way down to his moral philosophy? Probably. But what's interesting is that you can't really detach his what he has to say about race from what he has to say about aesthetics. That being the case, right? Kant saw a discussion about race, and no matter how racist that discussion is, Kant saw a discussion about race as being central to philosophy, and so he becomes a very honest sort of confrontation with the intersections between race, politics, culture, and aesthetics. So why I lean a lot on Kant in this book is this in those chapters in this book is to say that is to point out that for Kant's aesthetics hinges on two different types of aesthetics: the aesthetic of the sublime, or the analytic of the sublime, and the analytic of the beautiful. The beautiful tells us one discourse about the absolute limit of representation. What can we represent in its totality? And the beautiful itself is not a representation, but it is that condition through which all representations adhere as a unity. And that seems to mirror one trajectory of post-racial discourse, the sort of progressive trajectory. Unfortunately, the same phenomena that can be seen as being emblematic of the beautiful may also be the sublime. And what I was really interested in with Kant was that Kant is fascinated with cognition's ability to represent its own limitation to itself. So that thing that it cannot represent, that thing that even when I say this, even when cognition says this is a unity, it also can double as, but that unity is only insofar as I can represent it, and that's a limit. Kant is fascinated that one can represent the limitation of a discourse, the limitation of one's own abilities to oneself. And he calls that the sublime. It's a sort of sublime terror that within every representation there is a silencing. There is a point at which we cannot go past. There is a point at which the unity may simply be a disunity further on down the road, right? And I think that there's something really interesting about that. Now, Kant then goes on to say, well, the cognition then ennobles itself by handling or managing or sort of closing off the sublime. And I wasn't so interested in that part of Kant. But I wanted to follow out this point where the sort of breaking point of representations in Kant's aesthetics. And I thought that was really interesting because it marks out a very different type of political discourse that is more hinged on that interruption of narrative or that silence within a discourse. And so I do see a sort of continuity between what Kant suggests at various moments in his aesthetics and Fanon's critique of post-colonial, Fanon's critique of colonialism and the sort of necessity to think at the breaking points of our cultural narratives. And so after Kant, I think what I end up doing in the book is that I engaged Kant's aesthetics. On the other hand, I tried to show that there is a reason to sort of break many of Kant's intuitions, and so from the aesthetic of the sublime, I wanted to then rebuild a way of thinking about our aesthetic engagement with politics that is at that breaking point of representation, that is able to sort of hold together the idea that we have a representation, but that itself is not enough. And that there's a way that we need to collectively organize our activity around those things that are so great that we cannot actually represent them. So great tragedy is something that we cannot represent, but that doesn't mean that we cannot mourn. And mourning becomes a very important term in the book, because mourning is not just a practice that one undergoes by oneself. Mourning is a practice that one takes up in a community. And as such, it itself is not about just the representation, but about the practice. And I think that with post-racial discourse so heavily focused on representation, the sort of counter move is not to have counter representations, but to have counter practices. And so a practice of mourning, which is a communal effort, I think is a move in that direction. And so an example of this might be something like when Sandra Bland was murdered in Texas, or was found dead in Texas, in a Texas cell, what would it mean to not just have folks representing the tragic, but to have a community claim that death as a death of their own, and to initiate a practice of mourning that honors the gravity of that violence. And I think that's something that we continually have to rethink, is what's going on, not just with the representation, but with our own practices. And in what way is a practice of mourning missing from much of our activity?
And that brings us into the conclusion of the book, actually, with that, you know, you've touched on this quite a bit in your discussion of Kant, but that question that you pose, actually, about how to keep these practices of resistance alive as living practices, but mm-hmm. referring to, as you describe it, the formative violence of our context. So I wonder if you could point towards the kind of, the keeping practices of resistance alive as a way of giving a sense of the conclusion of the book.
Yeah. So a lot of what I was interested in, what I was talking about in the book too, sort of is framed by this question that starts from Judith Butler's work, where she says, we have to think about the violence that frames us. How do we know the violence that frames us? And I was, again, very interested in kind of reworking that question within the context of anti-Black violence. But instead of looking simply at the discursive limits, right? I think that what we're pushed to do is to sort of rethink our agency. And what sort of counts as agency, and what sort of counts as complicity, right? And this ends up being sort of an open question, because we have to. I think what we have to think about relative to post-racial discourse, and specifically within the sort of post-racial limitations of memory or memorialization, is that many things that look like practices of resistance, through sort of assembly or through organizing or through representation, may actually be sort of just the representation of resistance, but that representation itself may be complicit with the furthering of mechanisms of oppression. So one way to think about this is that organizing and protesting and collectively acting, that's always good, but it may be responsive to, or it may be using the tropes of an outmoded form of oppression, one that's geared towards erasure, displacement, and sort of actively ignoring a population or people suffering. If our current mode of oppression is geared around accepting, representing, acknowledging that oppression, then those responses are actually become representations of resistance, but they become actually complicit with the furthering of our current mode of oppression. And so I think that at the end of the book, the question that I'm really trying to highlight is that the problem of our agency is one that we have to continually renew and to sort of think about in reference to what mode of oppression we are currently confronted with. And I think that far too often when we see something like an assembly of folks protesting a type of injustice, that somehow we think that is the moment of our agency. And I worry that that's the moment in which we are just representing our agency, and communally we need to sort of think about what sort of practices continue a sort of resistance to our current forms of oppression. I don't think that we can do that without highlighting the intricacies of the way post-racial discourse works.
Is this something you'll be taking forward in future projects? Obviously, we started by thinking about how timely the book is. But is this a kind of ongoing philosophical agenda for you, or are you switching to something kind of completely different now you've written the book?
Yes and no for both, I think. In terms of thinking about agency, I think the question of agency, the question of community, the question of the limitations of our representations, those are all things that I'm still actively engaged in, and I'm looking forward to doing more. Post-racial discourse is something that I am that the book is about, and so at some other point I'll probably take that up. But so the projects that I'm currently working on are now sort of thinking about and rethinking about the place of African genocides in our cultural memory. And so I'm working on two things, a collection of an anthology that highlights the way in which African genocides have been decontextualized. And then I'm working on a second book that is looking at the hermeneutical problems of trying to interpret African genocides outside the context of the Holocaust, outside the context of sort of European genocides. And in my second book project, again, questions of agency, questions of race and gender formation, questions of identifying violence, questions of what it means to be in a post-genocidal community are all at play. And so but for the next project, I'm shifting gears to sort of think about the problem of colonialism, and rethinking decolonialism, and sort of thinking sort of about global politics. And definitely aesthetics is, and then aesthetic analysis is driving it, because that's kind of where my background is.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. I've been your host, Dr. David Bryan. On this episode, I was talking to Alfred Frankowski, an assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy and African American Studies at Northeastern Illinois University, about his new book, The Post-Racial Limits of Memorialization Towards a Political Sense of Mourning, which was published by Lexington Books in 2015.